Hi, and Laura's eating a scone. And welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
I'm Lars from Brooklyn.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. Each week, our two offices come together to celebrate the people and processes that operate behind the scenes to make creative work happen, as well as some of the thoughts and tools that are shaping our industry. While we have a certain focus on advertising, illustration, and animation, the topics and ideas discussed here should hopefully be of universal value to those on both sides of the equation of the applied arts. This podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as a bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence, no matter what the medium. This week, we take another dip into the Open Tabs segment, where we do a bit of a deep dive into some of the links that have been going through our Slack professional development channel. We'll be going over one of the most controversial hot button potential plagiarism issues in Melbourne, as well as giving some advice for industry standards on rates for producers and commissioners, and also talk about how to avoid virtual miscommunication. But first, Lara, how is that scone?
I'm only like a third of the way through, Jeremy, and I really, really want to finish eating it. But, you know, I respect the podcast process too much. Otherwise, I'm much the same as I was before because we're recording two episodes in one week. So
I know, but we are consummate professionals, so nobody will know that happened. It'll just be a smooth transition and we're going to sound like completely different people.
Absolutely.
Bianca, isn't that right, Bianca?
Oh, gosh, I feel great. That was incredible acting. I don't know. No, oh my gosh, double podcast. Yeah, it's
double podcast.
I'm getting hungry. It's like 8:30. I haven't had dinner yet. So let's get into it.
Okay. This is another Open Tabs episode where we will go through some of the links that have been going through our professional development channel, but going through them in a bit more kind of detail than we usually get to, because especially in the last few weeks, there's been a lot of hot button issues that have been cropping up in our industry. And we talked last week about the H&M issue with Revoke and using his work in their photography campaign. And less than around, you know, 2 weeks since that happened, a similar incident happened here in Melbourne, very close to home, between an organization and a local artist who's actually exhibited before at Lamington Drive, Esther Olson. Lara, why don't you give us a bit of a background, kind of what happened, what the backlash has been, and, you know, and where things are at now?
Yeah. So, you know, as you said, we have another example here where a company has been called out for their bad behavior, although I definitely think this is quite a different situation to what we were discussing with regards to H&M. It's just a bit more sinister in nature. I think everything about this one makes me just feel kind of icky. Basically, just yesterday, there was, an absolute whirlwind when a close friend of Jackie Winter and local Melbourne artist Esther Olson publicly told of her recent interactions with, you know, the enormous Christian organization Hillsong.
And maybe for our international listeners, maybe we talk a bit more about what Hillsong is and what position they have in Australia.
I mean, I guess I don't personally engage with Hillsong, so I don't know a huge lot about them. I mean, they're a church, basically, which is geared towards...
They're a mega youth. Church.
They're
though.
A mega church. Yes. They're an absolute massive
mega church. Is Justin Bieber a member?
They're enormous, and they're really geared towards sort of youth markets, and they sort of present themselves as kind of the cool, the hip church.
Well, they record these albums and performances, basically.
Rock shows, which are like, the production is insane.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. You have to really look it up to get a real sense for who Hillsong are and the kind of presence that they have. But it is enormous. And what sort of happened, really, it all started with them emailing her about their interest in collaborating with her. And, you know, there was nothing inherently wrong with that first email. In fact, it was, if you read it, it was a really friendly, polite email telling her that they were, you know, really big fans and would love to work with her. However, Esther met up with them later to discuss the project, and she had decided internally already that the organization didn't align with her own values. And so she ended up turning the request down, which is 100% within her rights to do so. The problem is that they then sort of proceeded to show her some work they'd created that was inspired by her work. And at this point, Esther still kind of thought that they were asking her to collaborate and create something similar, but not long after, she discovered they'd actually used this work without her permission across all sorts of merchandise and branding material. In her own words, she mentions in an article, so they sat me down at a little cafe by my house and showed me the development and then basically showed me the final image. And I was like, do you want me to recreate this? In my head, I was thinking this. And then they were like, this is what we're running with. And then closed the computer and that was the meeting. So she later emailed them to say that she felt really uneasy about the whole thing and could they please send her the work again so she could see how closely it looked like her own work, and she received no reply. And then later, a friend showed her on the Hillsong Instagram that this derivative work had been used across album artwork, t-shirts, stage designs, and all sorts of other stuff. So from there, and this is what sort of all went down yesterday, Esther took to Instagram to share what had happened. And as we now, you know, and we were discussing last week with the Revoke graffiti example, the art community has a real way of rallying around an artist when they've been wronged. So it really blew up from there with various media outlets reporting on the issue. And then it all culminated in a very, very intense interview on ABC Radio with John Fain. Now, if you haven't listened to this, I definitely encourage you to do so. And we'll be posting the link in our podcast notes and newsletter. It's a fascinating listen. John first interviews Esther about what happened and the deeply personal references that she's used in the work. And then, which I wasn't expecting, he brings on Tim Winkop, who is the CEO of Hillsong Music. And I was listening to this just like, damn, I felt like Jerry. So that's where things get just absolutely brutal. There's no other way to word it. John Fain absolutely takes him to task and ferociously argues for Esther's side of the story. It is a very uncomfortable listen, but also it's pretty incredible to hear John's support for Esther. And Esther is audibly shaken and anxious, and this sort of does stop her from being able to fully articulate things. So John steps in to very confidently and capably put Hillsong on the spot and demand that they compensate Esther. He just absolutely tears Tim to shreds. By the end of the conversation, Tim sort of agrees to compensate Esther. But I think, of course, you know, the actual negotiations are still to be had. And at the time of recording this episode, they're very much still ongoing. This only sort of went down yesterday. But John gives, he says that he'll give Esther his number and can help represent her. And it's really interesting. Have you listened to this? What do you guys think about all this?
I want to get a few facts straight first, though, before we kind of go more into things. Like, so just to clarify, the actual piece that is in question was, you know, it was an original work, like someone else had kind of has done something, but there is, and like, I don't, and again, I'm just kind of trying to state the facts here in mm-hmm. a way, none of her work was actually kind of directly replicated, but the obvious, I think there's some crossover in kind of themes and execution, color palette, all those things that it could very easily be confused with her work, especially
absolutely.
Because of the process that kind of happened. So I think that, you know, that's kind of one thing that I think is going to be interesting to see how this kind of plays out, because I think just like the H&M thing, like this is something that could have so easily been avoided in terms of how it was kind of handled. Whether there are kind of legal implications there in terms of whether her moral rights were compromised and how that all works from a legal perspective, I don't know if I'm qualified to talk about that. I mean, this would be a good conversation to have with Yasmin from Media Arts Lawyers or someone who's really kind of versed in that. But I think this is kind of one of the really, it's going to be a battle that's going to be won in the press and, you know, behind the scenes rather than in the courts, which I think is a bit difficult because, yeah, this is going to be something that's going to be really kind of hard to prove because they did not like take her work and, you know, replicate it. They have effectively, but like, you know, they were obviously looking at her work, and I see this stuff happen kind of all the time. And it's so depressing that the artists who have been wronged in these situations have no kind of recourse. So I feel great that it has kind of gotten the attention that it needs.
Yeah, because in the end, that's probably what's going to cause them to have to do something to compensate rather than, like, let's say if it was all done in court, I don't know whether she'd actually be able to
she wouldn't be able to
hold it up legally. I don't think she would be able to. But because of the negative response from the public, and especially the way that sort of John framed things during that interview, I think that they're going to be, you know, pushed into compensating her in some way. And I think that's a good thing.
I just don't, it just blows my mind how, I mean, maybe it's a different culture in other places, but like, you know, these issues don't really kind of blow over anymore. You know, like, you know, every creative person has a voice on kind of social media. And it's like, you know, if you're just kind of like, I'm just putting my producer hat on here at the moment. If you approach this artist and kind of, I don't want to kind of relay all these kind of steps. It just kind of seems crazy that it kind of ended up this way.
Yeah. I mean, it really irks me that in the end, Hillsong are this enormous mega church with this ridiculous amount of money, you know, and they're spouting these sort of Christian values, and yet they've gone and knowingly done something, which is clearly not okay.
Well, this is, you know, we talk about that Cryptonesia article that we talked about the other week, which is, I don't think you were here actually, me and B were talking about it, how we have the tendency to kind of rip off ourselves or to kind of think things are new kind of when they aren't. And I think anytime, what I kind of spoke about in that segment is I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Like,
well, oh, church devil, gotcha.
Anyway, they probably don't think they did anything wrong. And that was kind of my kind of take of what the conversation was. Like, you wouldn't get on there to kind of defend yourself if you really kind of didn't believe that you did something wrong.
Well, the
right?
part that makes me think that they really didn't was that they took her out, showed her the works. They weren't trying to hide it, I guess.
They were trying to get her blessing.
They were trying to get her.
Oh, come on.
Jeremy. I'm intrigued by what, you know, they were initially attempting to do. It's hard to tell that now when, you know, what they're saying is so crafted by a PR person and, you know, they're trying to put a spin on something because of the potential legal ramifications or cost ramifications. I'm interested to know what their actual thought process was and whether they actually were aware that what they were doing was not kosher.
Yeah, look, I think there's this whole kind of pylon mentality as well that like kind of makes me feel a bit uncomfortable in some ways when I kind of just see anyone, like there's definitely like a huge outpouring and it's a very kind of emotional thing because it goes to, you know, someone who has worked with most creatives here in Melbourne who is very kind of well liked, and I think, you know, the fact that her, I guess, financial well-being has been, you know, compromised in this way, it makes it kind of a real personal thing. I mean, B, what was, did you have a look at this from afar? What kind
of
opinions
I mean,
did you have?
I feel for her. It must be really awful to be in a position where, you know, you do have to actually put yourself out there in order to fight for your worth as an artist. I really like sympathize with that. But I think it really does kind of like bring up this gray area because unfortunately, as we know, style isn't actually protected by copyright. And that's what I'm really, I think this is more of like an ethical debate about what's like the nice thing to do rather than something that is legal, just unfortunately because style isn't protected under copyright. And I think that, yeah, Hillsong took some very bad steps in the way that they approached this and what they did. One thing that did make me uncomfortable listening to the ABC interview, I did feel a bit uncomfortable about the on-air negotiation. I mean, I can see that John Fain was trying to make a point, but it felt a bit sensationalist. And and I think I get a little bit uncomfortable. Yeah, maybe when things are pulled into the media, it's probably not personally how I would want things to play out. And I don't think Esther perhaps was expecting the response that she got and for this to blow up as big as it did. And I think for artists, it kind of really highlights how valuable sometimes it can be to have someone negotiating on your behalf. Like, I think that's a really great thing.
I think, you know, everything you're talking about is right there. And in some ways, you know, even bad publicity is good publicity in some ways. And I think if there's any kind of silver lining here is that Esther's work is being exposed to a much larger audience than it could have ever, you know, had before. Obviously, it's a terrible way for it to kind of come about. But yeah, no, she's a very talented artist. And, you know, I hope this all gets resolved in her favor. And, you know, we'll come back and talk more about it when we find out. Moving on, speaking of kind of, I guess, you know, public outrage, this is a Twitter link that kind of goes into a bit of a tweet storm and responses as well that, B, you posted up on our Slack, which is a tweet from Eleanor Davis, who goes by at SquinkYellow. Eleanor is a phenomenal illustrator, author, creative person. She wrote a tweet in all caps that said, "Show me a bridge and I'll burn it." And it's basically a screen cap with some redacted sections of a client who's come to her for, you know, some kind of advertising commission and, you know, kind of offering their £700 fee. And then with her kind of response explaining, you know, why the fee is so low and pretty much kind of turning it down. The whole exchange there that's excerpted is pretty minimal. It's just kind of two emails. But then she goes on to kind of, you know, make some really excellent points. And again, there's another kind of pile on here. So I'll just kind of read the exchange here so I can put it in context for people who want to kind of follow along. So the first email goes, "Hey, Eleanor, thanks so much for getting back to me so quickly. I'm afraid they're not at all flexible on cost. We've been running this series of ads for them for over a year now, and the £700 is fixed. If you're still interested, let me know. Otherwise, I completely understand your situation." And then Eleanor responds, "Thanks. I'm afraid £700 is too low. That's closer to the rate for editorial illustration, not advertising. I wish the other illustrators you've been working with had a better understanding of their worth and knew the kind of value they are providing. Checking out Redacted site, I see you do beautiful work. I would love to collaborate with you in the future if you have any problems. projects you're able to pay industry standard for. So a bit of flair there at the end there in terms of just kind of, you know, sticking the dagger in some ways. But then Eleanor kind of follows up with a few great notes. And I think the one that I really kind of want to call out about is if you can afford, brackets, you've got money, reputation, privilege to advocate for better contracts, turning down work and potentially losing clients, please do so. If you can't afford to, you can't afford to. Don't beat yourself up. Join local DSA or something. Do you know what DSA is by any chance?
No idea.
I didn't get to the end of that. And the reason I kind of wanted to bring this to attention, I mean, there was a whole pylon of kind of other artists and other kind of creatives kind of, you know, piling on the poor client here. And I do feel a bit bad for the client because I think, you know, they, you know, who knows kind of what position they were in. Laura, what kind of response did you have to some of the tweets here?
Yeah, I think definitely what I really, really like is not so much the screenshot that she's posted, but the follow-up tweets. You know, she's done sort of all sorts of information and advice for other illustrators. And there is some really great stuff in there that I sometimes forget isn't common knowledge. Yeah, a lot of sort of very simple but sage advice. I think one of the things is just that ad work should pay more. If you're making them, she's got here like $5 signs, then they can afford to pay you $2 signs, you know. And also just things like making up a boilerplate contract for yourself. You know, you can sort of Google examples to work off. And at least that will be sort of a good exercise in what you want to see in a good one. And just asking friends who are smarter than you about what they charge and what terms they ask for. But I think what you were touching on before, like, I think, look, it is definitely up to each individual if they want to share these things, I suppose, although there are sort of privacy concerns to an extent. I think my issue is that while some of the responses are great, I think this is good. What she's written as her response to the client is you know, done respectfully, intelligently, and with sort of the correct information supporting her. Others are not. And I worry sometimes about this becoming too much of a trend, and that we'll start seeing artists blasting back on any inquiries with smaller budgets just for the glory of posting screenshots to Twitter. And that is certainly not appropriate in all or even most cases. I think there's definitely a danger of detracting from the more positive side of these things, which is, you know, equipping artists with the knowledge that they need to be able to open dialogues with uneducated clients about pricing and usage, and instead just focusing on naming and shaming people and skipping that constructive dialogue portion altogether. That said, you know, I do feel that it is very important that artists, especially young up-and-comers, are made aware that it is okay to challenge low fees and it is okay to educate clients when you're doing it correctly. But again, you know, what constitutes a low fee or deal-breaker conditions for one person is absolutely not going to be the same for the next person, and it shouldn't be. So again, there's a risk that people see these screenshotted responses and go, okay, it's never okay to do work for $800, when that's not necessarily the case. So I think I prefer something like Jessica Hisch's client email helper that does more to actually teach people to ask questions and understand clients' motivations before negotiating based on their specific needs.
I'm going to echo a lot of your sentiment there. Like, I do think there's definitely some legal, moral, and ethical issues in terms of posting screenshots, like, especially if, I mean, I don't know how much weight kind of privacy disclosures, you know, carry at the end of emails, but like when I'm writing an email, I expect that that's kind of a private conversation. So to have that kind of violated, I feel that is kind of problematic in lots of ways. I also think there's a lot of things that didn't happen in this exchange that we tried to talk about all the time in terms of finding alternative compensation models or having a deeper kind of discussion. So, you know, we're only kind of seeing a very kind of small part of it. Before I get stuck into it more, B, what was your initial reaction to this? This is something that you actually posted.
I mean, I probably wouldn't do it, but I do 100% agree, you know, with using your position of privilege to turn down work that's undervalued and educating the commissioner on the reasons why. Like, I 100% believe in that.
Yeah, I definitely think I agree with that. I agree with everything except perhaps the actual screenshot posting in some cases. Yes. Like, I think even she can screenshot her response, but perhaps not the actual, I don't know. Sometimes I think there are just some lines that we need to be really careful about crossing. When the point here is to educate, there's not necessarily any use in naming and shaming unless someone has done truly something like really, really awful.
Yeah, look, I think it's a very personal issue because it comes down to your kind of livelihood and, you know, the money you make, just like we were speaking about with Esther. It really kind of transcends a lot of kind of professional and personal boundaries there. And I think one of the biggest issues with assignment-based work is, especially for illustrators and even more so for photographers, is that fees have really, and writers or anyone kind of who is a freelancer in that way, that wages have really stagnated, like, badly. You know, we talked about the Ben the Illustrator survey the other week, and, you know, the shocking figure that most kind of, you know, most people were not making money from their art, or they were kind of living in poverty. And, you know, I try to kind of keep that in perspective as well. It's like, you know, when we're negotiating an advertising job, you know, some illustrators are, there's so many people working out there. You're lucky if you get one or two big advertising jobs a year, and you might look at a job and say, hey, I'm getting 30 grand for this job. Like, that seems like amazing. But if that's the only job that you're booking all year, and maybe some editorial on top of that, you are literally living below the poverty line. And that 30 grand, like, kind of isn't, you know, enough. And that's why kind of this whole idea of value-based pricing is really important to, as something to kind of look at. I mean, I do like that Eleanor then kind of goes and breaks kind of a few more kind of points down. And it's tough. I don't know if it would have gotten the same response if she didn't kind of post that exchange there. I think there's that kind of tabloidness of it that people kind of like to see, you know, blood in the water kind of in some kind of ways. So yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword in there.
I do think it is really important for creatives and commissioners perhaps to be having these conversations and, you know, talking to each other about fees and unfair contracts. Like, I think that that's really important, and I'm very grateful that, like, I have a community both within Jackie Winter and, you know, like, being able to run fees by some of the designers that I share an office here with, you know, in like a general sense, just to kind of get a bit of a gut check. Like, I think that is really important.
I think it's absolutely important as well. And I think going back to the other side of, like, if you are a producer and if you are in the job of commissioning artwork, you know, you are doing your best job when you're commissioning the best artists and you're fostering the best, you know, circumstances to get the best work and to make the best relationships. And you cannot deny that fees are a huge part of that. You're having this professional relationship in that way. So I think that, you know, just like we were talking about with H&M, like, if you're a producer and a commissioner, like, it is up to you to kind of educate yourself on kind of what's right, what's wrong, not just kind of the hard kind of legal facts, but the, you know, the softer things as well. Like, what are the kind of current industry standards of rates? You know, what is kind of fair? And if you are given then work that is kind of unfair, you know, it would be just like if you, like, kind of started a new job and were given kind of, you know, a laptop from 15 years ago, you wouldn't be able to do your job, you know, with outdated tools. So just like for the same time, if you are kind of, you know, a cog in the machine and you're only kind of given this kind of certain budget, then, you know, it's up to you to kind of, you know, figure out with, you know, people that are either above you or kind of with you, how to kind of get the circumstances better to, you know, engage the talent you need. So look, there are so many kind of different resources out there, but the links that I want to kind of specifically point out that we love using, I think without a doubt, the AOI is the, I think, ground zero of fantastic information, not because of the fact that they, you know, have a huge database of members and clients, and they've used that to kind of make a pricing survey that they seem to update every kind of 2 to 3 years. And they also have a pricing hotline as well for kind of, you know, for their kind of members. I don't know if anything would stop a client from being able to use that kind of pricing hotline. You know, I don't know if it's just for illustrators, who knows, but something interesting there. So the AOI is fantastic. And look, if you're a really good producer, you will go kind of outside of your fields as well. So like something like the AOP, which is the Association of Photography, has amazing online tools as well and pricing calculators that you can use. I've always found that they are way the price. I don't know, they're way inflated prices, even to us. Like, I think they're always a lot higher than I think you'd ever get in kind of the real world. It's putting a stake in the ground to kind of see, okay, this is, you know,
it's a bit of a reference point.
Exactly. It's a reference point. Speaking of reference points, the Graphic Artists Guild, which is an organization based out of the States, they put out a book every, I think, not every year. I don't know what edition they're up to. They may be up to.
This is their ethical guidelines.
Yeah, the pricing and ethical guidelines. So, and it goes over any, the Graphic Artists Guild, so anyone who's ostensibly a graphic artist. So illustrators, textile designers, surface designers, merchandise designers, animators. It goes over everything, has printed pricing surveys in there as well. And what I kind of find interesting as well for Australia is that we kind of use the Graphic Artists Guild and the AOI as this kind of amalgamation. You get this American and European perspective in there. Also, I like looking at the AIGA for designers. They have pricing and salary kind of surveys, or even going into more kind of niche audiences like the Australian Cartoonist Society, which has a pricing guideline. And there's you know, even stuff like Getty, for example, we often kind of turn clients onto Getty all the time when we're trying to say, like, okay, well, here's, you know, here's a more objective kind of third party. They use rights managed images. Here's kind of, you know, how they calculate their prices. So if you want to compare, you can see what it's kind of like over here. And another thing that I'm finding more and more useful are kind of these little private Slack and Facebook groups. And I know for advertising producers and account managers, I think LinkedIn was doing a lot of it before with kind of the private groups there, but now I've noticed it kind of move a lot more kind of on Slack, and you're able to kind of have these more kind of candid discussions and, you know, figure things out from there. So look, I'll put the links to all of these different kind of sites on our show notes, and hopefully this proves to be a useful resource for some of you commissioning so we can, you know, do better together. Bianca, you are going to round us out with the last link of the week, how to avoid virtual miscommunication.
Well, my link, Lee, our lovely colleague, posted a HBR article on how to how to collaborate effectively if your team is remote, which actually led me to this article also on HBR titled How to Avoid Virtual Miscommunication, which I guess is just basically...
By HBR, you mean Harvard Business Review, right?
Oh, yes. So yeah, I just virtually miscommunicated.
So what's the crux of the article?
Well, I mean, as you guys know, I live and work here in New York with a small team here. And
wait, what?
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 Guys, I'm in New York.
It's a news to me.
But you know,
I thought you just took
your
the time.
Cover is blown, Bianca.
Too far.
But you're all in Melbourne. The majority of the artists that we represent here in North America are based in Australia, and because of the time zone difference, the majority of my communication with pretty much everyone that I work with happens over email. Daylight savings has just begun here, which means that I now have a very limited crossover hours with the Southern Hemisphere during normal business hours to actually get anything done. So this puts a lot of pressure on me. And I guess this article, it argues that lack of context is the main cause of miscommunication in the virtual workplace. And we talk a lot on the podcast about working remotely and I guess like how to make that as effective as possible. And one of the things that I found from this article was a little something that psychologists call signal amplification bias. And that's basically thinking, oh, I'm sure he understood what I meant. It should have been obvious how I felt. It goes without saying. And yeah, the most...
How is that different from just making assumptions?
Well, I guess it is making assumptions. You know, this article kind of sums up that the most common cause of... miscommunication in any relationship is a very simple one, which is we routinely fail to realize how little we are actually communicating. In other words, we think we say a lot more than we actually do. And interestingly, the risk of this is actually greater with people we know well, so friends, family members, and romantic partners, than it is with a stranger. And I actually, I find that, I mean, like, Jeremy, you and I have worked together for 6 years now, and like, I do find every now and again, like, because we have such a close relationship and we've been working together for so long, that sometimes, like, a moment I'm just like, I have no idea what Jeremy's even talking about, because you send me like a four-line email or like a four-line Slack, and then I'm like, what is going on? But like anyone else, it's like totally fine. So I don't know.
That's a Jeremy thing. That's Jeremy specific.
But like, I think I do the exact same thing. Like, I think the like working remotely, it is really difficult because, you know, like I think even the context and the time that, you know, I'm perhaps communicating with people, like I need to sometimes really think about the fact that, you know, sometimes I'm on the subway and I just, you know, because I have this like short window of time where, you know, an artist is awake and I need an answer, like, you know, my emails can be quite short because like I just, you know, I'm sort of like between work and dinner and I just need to get an email out. And it just like, it really highlights like how important it is to communicate as much context as possible in the least amount of words as possible. And that's a difficult thing to do sometimes.
Laura, is that something you've experienced at all?
I was thinking about that idea of like whether miscommunication is greater with the people that you're closer with. And it's an interesting question. I have to say, like, I've never really considered that. I think I have a tendency to over-communicate regardless of who I'm speaking to. So I tend to give like way too much information. But yeah, I definitely think you could perhaps have something there in the sense that, you know, with the people you're really close with, you assume that you don't have to explain as much, which might sometimes be true, but certainly not always. There were like all different points sort of in there about how you can avoid this virtual miscommunication. And one of those was one that we talk about a lot, which is sort of replying just to say that you have got something. I know, B, that really, that's a big thing for you, like making sure that people tell you they've received your message, you know, like especially when you're communicating hours and hours apart. And so it's funny because Jeremy and I had like a weird incident of that recently where I've been like pinging him about something. And you were like, eventually I was like, Jeremy, stop ignoring me after like 5 times. And you were like, I'm not ignoring you. I just don't have anything to add. But in my head, you had just like hadn't read it. So it's just those little things that consider, whereas if we were talking in person, I could tell if you were like nodding and, you know, I know that you've heard something compared to like, yeah, if you were just like facing the wall. And not,
let's just
not
all gang up on Jeremy.
Yeah, this is fun.
Yay.
I'm cool. I don't have my review till like October.
Well, it's an interesting piece. I mean, it's, I think it does kind of, it's the conceit is pretty basic. And I just think it comes back to the point that I think we don't know ourselves as good as we think. And I think our own perceptions of our own behavior, is wildly, you know, different to what is kind of actually kind of happening. It's just kind of that whole thing about like how, you know, just like you don't know the sound of your own voice. Yeah, like I just think this is, you know, just another reason for why we should kind of engage in activities that increase our own emotional intelligence and our own kind of awareness.
Yeah, and I think as well, in terms of us, like, you know, we joke about all piling on you, but you are the busiest man I've ever come across in my entire life. And I think it's interesting to see how that kind of then plays into maybe issues of virtual miscommunication or not, you know? I think like definitely it's something that's going to be a problem for someone the busier they are.
Yeah. All I just really just kind of want to keep working in the term virtual insanity to this and make a great Jamiroquai reference. But I can't figure it out how to get the pun in.
I was wondering what that look on your face was.
Yes, exactly. Because I'm such a busy man, but if you looked inside my head, it would just be Jamiroquai reference.
To be real, you are an excellent communicator, Jeremy. And I think it's just because we have been working together for so long that we maybe take that relationship for granted at times.
This is also why, like, I think it's the people who are making the tools for communication also need to kind of take some responsibility. And in terms of, you know, what systems we actually kind of use, I don't think anyone expected emoji would actually become such a, you know, it's such an old piece of tech, but it was picked up, I think, specifically to make more efficient use of communication, because instead of having to type something out, you can just kind of get this kind of coded language of kind of hieroglyphics. So I think, you know, if we are kind of doing more and more kind of as creatives and as kind of thinkers and trying to fit more in less time, well, something's got to give. I think, you know, you could get in a very dangerous situation, like, you know, newspeak, like, you know, like for 1984, where, like, you just start eliminating words from the dictionary because
that's my nightmare.
Oh, well, I mean, but
yeah. It's interesting, like all that stuff has come up recently with like them sort of trying to figure out how to figure emoji sort of speech into like legal cases where, like, for example, like, can emojis be considered like violent threats? You know, if someone has sent, there were cases of like someone's ex-husband sending like a gun emoji and whatever, all this stuff. And like whether that can be used as examples of you know, intent to assault and stuff. It's really interesting seeing how the sort of language has changed in this digital world.
I mean, and Jeremy, you're always kind of championing the use of like having video conference calls and being able to actually see the other person that you're speaking to. And one of the like tips that they actually suggest in this article is to, if you know, if you start working with someone remotely that you're going to be, you know, having like a kind of like a long-term working relationship with, is to actually like to each exchange kind of like these like video sort of like tours of your office so that you have this like context of where the person actually is when they're working. And then when you're communicating with them, so you actually put yourself in the position of the other person and actually visualize that individual in their office as you send them an email. Do you think that would work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just basic development of empathy. I mean, that's why you get kind of, you know, troll cultures, because, you know, people are communicating without any context that there's another kind of person on the other end. And I think, yeah, that's just
basic.
Basic business for basic people.
Basic people.
Sorry, that was my G-rated version of that statement. But look, some really great links here. We will post the links to everything on our podcast specific website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. If you want to receive the links to everything we talk about for this and every other episode, you can sign up to our podcast specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Mm-hmm. Moving on, rounding things off like we like to every week, the most Melbourne and the most New York thing that's happened to us this week. I'm seeing a lot of blank stares because not much has happened between the time we recorded this and now.
Bianca? Well, I don't know if this is a particularly New York thing or perhaps just like a byproduct of living in such a densely populated city where there seems to be enough of an audience for anything. A friend of a friend of mine is an incredible guitarist and puts on these shows where he performs like popular rock songs on the guitar. And it's basically like this communal karaoke session, which is kind of my dream night out.
Well, isn't there that whole piano bar culture in New York at the moment that's like just coming to Melbourne?
Yeah, they've tried to open some here, but it sounds like my
it would never
nightmare.
Work in Melbourne. But anyway, so everyone just sits around and it's a communal karaoke session. Everyone gets to sing along. But anyway, this guy's name is Ray and Ray just plays the guitar. So the fun thing that happens at these shows is to try and find a place in the lyrics to substitute his name, Ray. I mean, that's basically it.
Like what? Give us an example.
Like, Ray, ooh. I don't know. That's not a very good one, but it's an...
That was terrible.
You could put anything in there. Pizza, ooh. I mean, I can't sing like you, but you get the gist. My Melbourne thing is almost a New York thing in that, like, just... Like, I just learned another one of my friends from my advertising course and who I've sort of since been working in this industry with over the last however many years is moving to New York because it's impossible to keep any advertising creatives in Melbourne, apparently.
Oh, Laura, I thought you were going to talk about the dog fashion show that you went to.
That was Mel. Are we the same person to you?
Yeah, you're all kind of just one, you know, set of interchangeable parts.
I am so deeply insulted. But yeah, I mean, really, we should just have Mel on for a whole episode to talk about the dog fashion show she went to. It was actually like part of Fashion Week.
It looked amazing. And it was at the Park Hyatt, which is kind of a bit of a chain. And we have spoken about the Park Hyatt's resident dog before as a previous Most Melbourne thing. So making a second appearance. Okay, that'll do us for this week. Thank you very much, Bianca.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. And Laura finally gets to finish her scone. Good work, Laura.
Oh.
Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. You can also sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter where we send you the links and download links to our episodes every week at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And also, we are now on Stitcher as well as Spotify, so listen to us on any platform of your choice. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye, bye, bye,
Ray.
Ray. Bye.